has abandoned the thought of non-harming here, to cultivate the thought of harming here. And then his mind inclines to thoughts of harming here. So, here we have this idea of habits, how you create habits in your life, and why we have habits in a certain way here. And it says here, what we frequently think and ponder upon. Now these words, thinking and pondering upon, these are the words vitakka and vichara in Pali. And these basically mean any kind of movement of the mind. Anywhere where the mind goes, that is what is meant by thinking and pondering here. Thinking and pondering sounds a bit too much, because this is from the very slightest movement of the mind to the most kind of involved sort of thinking. The whole spectre is involved here in thinking and pondering here. So whatever you incline your mind towards, whatever your mind tends to be in terms of harming or sensual desire or whatever it is, that is where a habit is formed. And that's why we have habits. And you know what it's like when you, sometimes when you, a certain person says something to you or a certain person does something to you, you get upset. Or when they say something to you and they do something, you feel a sense of happiness, because that is what you are conditioned to. This is your inclination of the mind. This is the habit. And these habits are, for that reason, precisely because they're habits, they're very difficult often to get out of. We tend to react in the same way, in the same situation, to the same people, again and again, in exactly the same way. And that's why it is hard. And this happens precisely because we have cultivated that particular thing in the past. Not deliberately, but it happens as a matter of course. So because of that, what the Buddha is saying here, or the Bodhisattva is thinking, is that you actually need to be able to overcome this. This comes later on. You have to actually change the way you think. By changing the way you think, you are gradually changing your habits. And by gradually changing your habits, you will see this in your own life. When you start to think in a new way, when you start to look at people in terms of compassion and kindness, because your perceptions are changing here, you find that after a while, your habits are changing. You don't look upon that person in the same way anymore. You don't react with the same force when they say something you don't like. And things start to change. And that is a sign that you're moving in the right direction. And all of this comes with the practice of meditation, of understanding the metta practice, of looking at people in a new way, looking at situations in a new way. This is what the Dhamma is all about. And then the inclination changes, and the inclination move towards kindness and compassion instead of ill will and sensual desire. And of course, this is also very important in terms of the Buddhist idea of rebirth. Why is it that we are the person that we are in this life? And very largely, it is because of the habits that we built up in past lives. That's why we are who we are now. That's why we all have different personalities, where we have different inclinations, different ways of doing things, precisely because we come into this life with all this baggage from the past. And, of course, if we're not careful, we are going to create baggage also for the future life. So whatever you do in this life, that is what is going to be the inclination of your mind in the future. So in a sense, you are creating your future here and now in this life. How you tend to think now is also going to be how you think in the future. So this is your chance to make sure that if you want to have a good life in the future, you have to develop the mind right here, right now, so that you take something with you into the future life that's beautiful and nice and wonderful. So this is basically, if you like, an aspect of the idea of karma. Karma that you are creating your future right here, right now, through your habits. So that is the first paragraph there. Then the Buddha goes on to talk about the opposite. So far we have talked about the negative states of mind. Then, as is usual in the suttas are very thorough. They take all aspects into account. So now the Buddha goes on to talk about the opposite aspect, the good kind of thinking here. And he says, as I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of non sensual desire or renunciation arose in me, I understood thus, this thought of non-desire has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom, does not cause any trouble in the mind, and leads to Nibbana. If I think and ponder upon this thought even for a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration, samadhi. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, brought it to singleness, and concentrated it. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. So here you have the opposite. So the Buddha, or the Bodhisattva, before his awakening, he has abandoned the negative thoughts through insight and understanding. And because he has abandoned negative ones, the thoughts that remain in the mind are now the beautiful thoughts. So this is the thought of renunciation, or wanting to give up all sensual pleasures. And then later on, you also have the thought of non-cruelty, giving up all harming of living beings. And the thought of non-ill will, not having any bad thoughts about anybody at all. He has given these things up completely, absolutely. And his mind just has then the opposite qualities, basically, of compassion, of understanding, of equanimity, of kindness towards other beings. So this is what he has established in himself, just through this practice, just through his own wisdom. And from that, you can see how far the wisdom can take you. Just by reflecting in the right way, it can actually take you to the point where you can give up these negative mind states completely, at least for a time, for a certain period of time, until they eventually re-arise again. And then he says, once you have established these good qualities, they do not lead to my own affliction or to others' affliction or to the affliction of both. In other words, when you have that purity of mind, you don't act anymore in a negative way. You have clarity of mind. You act out of kindness. You act out of goodwill. And that is not acting for other people's affliction. It is true, sometimes people say, I'm kind to others, and then they react badly back. That is true. Sometimes people do react badly, even though we are kind. But the point here is that you are not acting for the other person's affliction. In that case, it is they who are acting for their own affliction. And that, of course, is something that you often cannot do anything about. All you can really do is to make sure that you are acting for the benefit of others. It aids wisdom. It aids wisdom because when you have a thought of non-desire, a thought of kindness, a thought of non-ill will, the mind is clear. There's no distortion in the mind anymore. You see things as they actually are. This is called in Buddhism, Yatha Bhuta Jnana Dasana. It means knowledge, seeing and understanding in accordance with the reality as things that actually are. Your mind is clear. You're not disturbed anymore. You have a sense of balance inside of you. It's one of these beautiful states. And this is part of what you see when you come here on retreat and you start to feel peaceful. The mind becomes powerful and clear. You start to see what this actually means, this seeing things in accordance with reality. The mind is not distorted anymore by ill will and desires. And then he says, because of that, because this is so useful and it leads to Nibbana, it's going in the right way, he says, I see nothing to fear from this. Another way of translating that is to no danger in these things. In other words, it doesn't lead to suffering. It doesn't lead to problems. It actually leads away from problems towards Nibbana and towards wisdom. So he says that even if I think about this for a whole day, for a whole night, for a day and night, there is nothing to fear. But, and this is where it becomes interesting, because this is where the Buddha makes his next step. The Buddha here is doing things step by step. First, he's overcoming the negative thoughts, and now comes the next step in his spiritual development. And what he says next is that, but if I do keep on thinking like this, using my mind, then the body is tired. And when the body is tired, the mind is disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from concentration. The purpose of meditation is to bring the mind to unity, to focus it, to, if you like, here the word concentration is used. As I said yesterday, you have to be careful how you understand this word. It does not mean concentration, how we are used to thinking about it with forcing your mind onto something. It's a natural focus on an object. It happens all by itself when you develop the mind in the right way here. So this is a natural focus on that object. But if you think too much, you're actually moving away from that natural focus. That is what the Buddha is saying here. Too much thinking, even if it's good thinking, is moving away. So eventually, not only do you have to overcome the bad thinking, you also have to give up the good thinking as well and make the mind completely still, completely calm, completely peaceful. And only then can you achieve really deep meditation practice. So what he is saying here is that when I think and ponder too much, when I have too much vitakka vichara, too much movement of the mind, essentially is what it means, then the body becomes tired. And you may wonder, why is it body? What does the body, what's this got to do with the body? Surely this has to do with the mind. And the reason is, it's just like when you use your mind too much in an ordinary, during an ordinary day, you think about things, you do this and that. After a while, you feel tired, right? Even the body feels tired. You want to go to sleep. It's like a physical thing, basically. The body is also affected by how you use your mind. So it's not just the mind. It actually also affects the body. So the body is also tired. And when the body is tired, the mind is disturbed. In other words, the mind is affected, basically, by the tiredness of the body. When you feel tired, you want to go to sleep. Often it's very hard to meditate because you just start nodding or you have sloth and torpor. It doesn't really work for you. So the body is tired, the mind is disturbed, and because the mind is disturbed or affected, you cannot focus on your object of meditation. You cannot focus on the breath, you cannot focus on anything really, and it doesn't work. So the Buddha is saying then that instead then, once the mind has been established in good states of mind, then comes the next step. You don't need to think about those good things all the time. The next step then is to unify the mind, to stop the thinking, to quieten the mind down, as it says here, and then bring it towards concentration, to bring it towards samadhi, stillness, unity of mind. That is the next step here. Because then, that is the true rest of the mind. Now, the mind is resting for the first time. During the ordinary days, we're never really resting the mind. We're always using it this way and that way. And that's why we get tired. But here is the first time you're actually resting it. And you know that it is rested because after you come out of an experience of samadhi, you feel energized. You feel the power inside of you. And that is how you know that your meditation has been successful, because you feel powerful and energized afterwards. That is the sign that the meditation has been working here. If you feel tired afterwards, it means you may still be going in the right track, but you haven't really gotten very deep yet. So you still keep on trying after that. So this is here the Buddha's gradual movement towards a mind that is powerful, rested, and can be used for more profound purposes later on. So that is the first paragraph. And then he does the same thing for non-ill will and then for non-cruelty. I'll just read through this. As I abided thus, heedful, energetic, and resolute, a thought of non-ill will arose in me. And then the same thing for ill will all the way down, and then the thought of non-harming arose in me here. The text has been abbreviated here not to be too repetitive. I understood thus, this thought of non-harming has arisen in me. This does not lead to my own affliction, or to the other's affliction, or to the affliction of both. It aids wisdom. It increases wisdom, is actually the Pali here. Panya Buddhika. Buddha means to increase, to give rise to wisdom. It increases wisdom. does not cause mental problems and difficulties and annoyance, and it leads to nibbana. If I were to think and reflect upon this thought or this for even a night, even for a day, even for a night and day, I see no danger from it. But with excessive thinking and pondering, I might tire my body. And when the body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed. And when the mind is disturbed, it is far from unity, from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quietened it. This is like becoming peaceful inside. No more thinking. The mind becomes steady rather than thinking. Brought it to singleness. This is like having one object in the mind, one object that you're focusing on. And then concentrated it, is the last word here. Why is that? So that my mind should not be disturbed. In other words, so that my mind should be rested. So that mind should be energetic. It should not dissipate its energy on too much thinking and pondering. And then, I skip one paragraph again. And then you have a simile down here. Just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have been brought inside the villages, a cowherd would guard his cows while staying at the root of a tree or out in the open, since he needs only be mindful that the cows are there. So too, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. So, in the previous simile, the cowherd will go tapping and poking on the cows to make sure they don't stray into the fields. In other words, in the previous simile, the cowherd, the meditator, is still guarding his mind. He's making sure that these negative states of mind don't arise. But here, when you have abandoned those negative states and you only have good states of mind, you're like the cowherd who just allows the cows to wander around, and all you do are just mindful that the cows are still present. You don't have to be careful anymore because there are no crops that can be eaten by the cows. So here you can relax more. You can just have more awareness. You don't have to be so vigilant about overcoming negative states of mind. And then again, the Buddha has the same paragraph again on what one frequently ponders upon. And he says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination, the habit of his mind. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of renunciation, he has abandoned the thought of sensual desire to cultivate the thought of renunciation, and then his mind inclines to thoughts of renunciation. If he frequently thinks and ponders upon thoughts of non-ill will, upon thoughts of non-cruelty, he has abandoned the thought of harming to cultivate the thought of non-harming, and then his mind inclines, has the habit of thinking in terms of non-harming. So again, habits are not only on the negative side, you also form positive habits. You learn how to look at things in a good way, in a nice way, and then the mind habitually goes in that direction. You start automatically to think in terms of kindness, of non-harming, of compassion towards others, in terms of renunciation. Once you have really internalized the danger in the opposites, the mind automatically inclines to those things which are good, which do not lead to that danger, but which lead to good result, to wisdom. If you want to be wise, if you understand that wisdom comes from the good states of mind, if you really understand that deeply, the mind will automatically go to the good states. That's what the Buddha is saying here. So this, again, is a wisdom practice. It's by seeing things in a new way, seeing the danger in certain things, understanding where wisdom is to be found. The more deeply you understand that, the more you reflect on that. And this is why a big part of the Buddha's teaching is about reflecting wisely, thinking wisely, understanding things in a new way. Then your mind changes, and then your habit becomes different. So you can see, if you have to do this, of course, over a long period of time. You have to do it again and again to remind yourself. And gradually you change. And your whole view of things becomes turned around from what it normally is. It's a very beautiful process that is happening here. Of course, it takes a lot of determination. It takes a really good understanding and of these things. But gradually you come around and these things start to happen. So then the Buddha has now come to the point where he has concentrated the mind. He has abandoned the bad states and also the good states. And then now we start to get into some much even more profound things. The next thing he says here is, tireless energy was aroused in me. An unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled. My mind concentrated and unified. So, what is happening here? Tireless energy is aroused. Why is tireless energy aroused? And the reason is because you have abandoned the defilements in the mind. First of all, when there's no defilements, the natural state of the mind is an energetic one. You have energy in the mind when the defilements are abandoned. And that energy becomes even more powerful when you abandon the thinking altogether, like the Buddha is doing here. But first of all, by abandoning defilements and negative mind states, energy becomes the natural state of the mind. It's a bit like if you think about, for example, sometimes you may have had a very good night's sleep and you wake up in the morning, you feel really energetic, you feel really well, you feel at ease. That is a kind of energy that you get also through abandoning the negative states of mind. It's this buoyancy of the mind, energy inside. And not only do you have that, but he says also unremitting mindfulness. In other words, mindfulness that doesn't slack, mindfulness that is well established, is also present. And again, and this is, I think, a very important point to understand here, that mindfulness gets established precisely because you have abandoned the defilements. That is why you have mindfulness. Mindfulness doesn't come about by brute force, by willpower. It comes about by how you use your mind. And if you use your mind to establish good states and to get rid of the bad states, then mindfulness happens all by itself. And you see this. This is not just here. You see this again and again in the word of the Buddha. You have the gradual training. The gradual training is a very powerful sutta, which I recommend you all to read. It's not only one sutta. It's found again and again. It's found in many, many different places. And in the gradual training, you can see how the basis of the practice is, first of all, just morality. And morality, of course, is purity in its most basic form. And then what is called sense restraint. And this is about purity of the mind, just like we're talking about purity of the mind here. And then once you have sense restraint, that is where mindfulness is established. So this is a standard theme in the suttas. Mindfulness comes about as a consequence of purity of the mind. Purity of conduct and then purity of the mind. This is very important because it means that if the mindfulness isn't strong enough for you to follow the breath or to do some other kind of meditation object, the reason is because there is some defilements that you haven't yet overcome, that you still have to deal with, so that mindfulness becomes established. That's basically what it means. So a very powerful and very important understanding of how the path of meditation actually works. Once you understand that, then you know what you have to do to establish enough mindfulness. And you see also this, you can also see it, for example, there's a famous set of qualities in the suttas called the Bhojangas. Bhojangas means literally factors of awakening. And in those factors of awakening, you see the same thing. You see mindfulness and energy coming very close together. First you have mindfulness, it says there. Then you have what is called investigation of qualities, dhammas, dhammavicaya, investigation of qualities. And investigation of qualities means investigating the mind, understanding bad states, understanding good states. Because once you understand the bad and the good, then you can do something to cultivate the good and overcome the bad, right? So you have sense of mindfulness, then you have the overcoming of all the negative states of mind, and then comes the virya, the energy of the mind. Again, you can see how mindfulness, energy, and the overcome of negative states all revolve around each other. This is what it's all about. So then, once that mindfulness is established, then the body becomes tranquil and untroubled. The body becomes very peaceful. It can be tranquil. This is the opposite of what we had before, where they said the mind is tired. The tired body is one that is a little bit upset, a bit agitated. This is the exact opposite. The body becomes very, very peaceful and very at ease, very light. You feel very good inside of yourself. The body starts to disappear completely at this stage because it's so light, it doesn't really matter anymore. You don't have to worry about the body. And when that happens to the body, then the mind starts to actually be able to concentrate. When the mindfulness is there, you have enough sharpness of the mind. You are enough in the present moment. There isn't any thing that draws you anywhere anymore. Then it is possible to focus on a meditation object like the breath. It happens by itself. You don't have to worry about it. And this is one of the tricks in meditation practice. Very often people try to focus on the breath. They use all kinds of techniques to try to hold the attention there. But the ideal way of practicing meditation is to just sit down, relax, overcome in negative states of mind, and then find the peace inside. And then as you find the peace inside, the breath appears by itself, because the breath is always there. And then when the breath appears by itself, that is when it happens automatically. The breath is there, your attention is there, and you just keep following that breath very gently. And this is like the natural path of meditation practice. No force is required, no willpower is required, and it all goes smoothly according to a plan. So, that gives you some idea of how the meditation works. And this, I'm going to emphasize this more later on as well as we see some of these other suttas. And now, from here on, things get very, even more profound and even more deep, because once the bodhisattva, the Buddha-to-be, has established his mind in samadhi, has unified it, the next thing he does is to enter these very deep states of meditation, samadhi. And this is all abbreviated in this sutta. The reason it's abbreviated is because it has been mentioned in previous suttas. But what comes next are the four jhanas, the four deep meditations, profound meditations. So I'm not going to go through this now because I want to focus on kind of the slightly more basic issues. These are very, very profound issues, so I'm not going to focus on that. And then once he has attained the four jhanas, then he has his enlightenment experiences. And his enlightenment experience is basically threefold. The first part of the enlightenment experience is that he recollects his past lives. This is part of the Buddha's enlightenment experience. Then he understands how rebirth happens in accordance with the laws of karma. This is the second enlightenment experience. And then eventually he has the full understanding that he has ended, himself has ended the potential for rebirth in the future by understanding reality, by understanding non-self, by understanding impermanence and understanding suffering fully, he ends the potential for future rebirth. And that is the third enlightenment experience. And he says here, this was the third true knowledge, and true knowledge is a word here for enlightenment experience, attained by me in the third watch of the night. Ignorance was banished, true knowledge arose, darkness was banished, and light arose, as happens in one who abides, heedful, energetic, and resolute. Powerful here. I'd like to point this out. Darkness was banished. Remember, he has just before that recollected his past lives. Recollection of the past life is called banishing of darkness, the arising of light. That's what recollection of past life is called. In other words, this is not just something that is unimportant. This is a profound aspect of the Buddhist teachings, that there is such a thing, according to Buddhism, as past lives and potentially future lives. When you see it directly for yourself, it is what happens is what he says here. Darkness is banished. You have seen something that is truly significant, truly important, that changes your entire understanding of life and of the meaning of life. That is how important it is. So sometimes people think that rebirth and these ideas are just Buddhist ideas. They're not really important. And I don't really have to worry about those things. And I say they are extremely important because they have tremendous consequences for how you live your life, how you think about your life, how you view your existence and what you should do about it. In fact, it is so important that without the idea of rebirth, there really isn't any Buddhism, because it is all about ending rebirth, really. Sometimes people have a hard time accepting rebirth, and that's fine. You don't really have to accept it. But what I say to people is, at the very least, don't reject it out of hand. Reflect upon this. Think about it. There is even today a lot of good scientific evidence to point in that direction. So don't reject it out of hand. And if you don't reject it out of hand, if you have an open mind at least, then that is fine as far as I'm concerned. But because it is so important, I think rejecting it out of hand is a dangerous thing to do. Anyway, so that is the conclusion there about enlightenment. I'm not going to say much more about that because it takes us a little bit away from the theme of this discourse. I'm going to read out the last simile here. It's quite a nice little simile that the Buddha gives at the very end. And this is a simile for the things that he has been talking about before. And he says, suppose, bhikkhus, that in a wooded range there was a great low-lying marsh near which a large herd of deer lived. Then a man appeared desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage, and he closed off the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he opened up a false path, and he put out a decoy and set up a dummy so that the large herd of deer might later come upon calamity, disaster, and loss. But another man came desiring their good, their welfare and protection, and he reopened the safe and good path that led to their happiness, and he closed off the false path, and he removed the decoy and destroyed the dummy, so that the large herd of deer might later come to growth, to increase and fulfillment. Monks, I have given this simile in order to convey a meaning. This is the meaning. The great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. The man desiring their ruin, harm, and bondage is a term for Mara, the evil one. The false path is a term for the wrong eightfold path, that is, wrong view, wrong intention, wrong speech, wrong action, wrong livelihood, wrong effort, wrong mindfulness, and wrong concentration. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. The dummy is a term for ignorance. The man desiring their good, welfare, and protection is a term for the Tathagata, the Buddha, the accomplished and fully enlightened. The safe and good path that led to the happiness is a term for the Noble Eightfold Path, that is, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So, monks, the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened by me. The wrong path has been closed off, the decoy has been removed, and the dummy destroyed. Beautiful simile there. You can reflect on the simile for yourself if you like. I'll just give you a few pointers on what is happening here. So first of all, he says that the meaning of the great low-lying marsh is a term for sensual pleasures. And the reason why it is called the low-lying marsh is because sensual pleasures are considered in Buddhism a fairly low form of happiness. There are happinesses that are much greater, much higher, much loftier, much more noble than sensual happiness. That's why it's called low-lying. And this is part or parcel of what you're trying to achieve in meditation practice, is to get a taste of those higher happinesses that are available. The large herd of deer is a term for beings. So it's like a herd of deer. You can imagine a herd of deer just moves around at random. They now move this way, they move that way, depending on the wind, depending on where the food is, depending on what's happening. They're a bit out of control. There's nobody really in charge. There's a sense of random movement. If you have seen maybe films of herds of deer, how they move, it doesn't really have any clear sense of direction. And that is the same, usually, with beings, with human beings, with anybody. We're often like these rudderless ships on the ocean. We're drifting now this way, now that way, depending on the conditions and causes that prevail upon us. We don't really know where we're going. It's this kind of almost this random movement moving around. And it all depends on the causes and conditions that affect us in life. And, of course, that can be a bit frightening when you understand that we are just like rudderless ships. It's a bit scary because it means you're not really in charge of your own life. And that is basically what the Buddha is saying. There's nobody really in charge. And Mara here, the evil one, this you can just take as a personification of the negative states of mind that tend to arise, and how easily it is to be tempted by these negative states of mind, how easily it is to follow them. But still, although they are easy to follow, they tend to be harmful and lead to the negativity and bad things in the long run. That's why they're called Mara, the evil one, because although they are tempting, they actually often lead to suffering and problems instead. And the false path here is this wrong view, etc., wrong way all the way down. This is like the practice which is opposed, basically, to the practice of the Eightfold Path, or the kind of practice, meditation practice, that the Buddha taught in the suttas. The decoy is a term for delight and lust. Again, it's because delight and lust is like craving. So you are being led astray by something which is very alluring and seems very nice, and yet it actually just leads you away. The dummy is a term for ignorance, avidya, not understanding, not seeing things clearly, not understanding things as they really are. Because you don't understand things as they really are, you tend to go the wrong way. And the idea of the Buddha, then, is the one who awakens to the true path, who sees these things before anybody else, and he points it out to give everybody else also a chance to follow the same way. So this is like a person who is very skilled in a particular area of life. Just as you go to a school or to university and you follow a professor because they know more about a particular field than you do, so the Buddha knows more about the development of mind and the understanding of life than we do. That is what is the foundation principle of Buddhism, that the Buddha knows these things. And that's why he is worth following according to Buddhism. So when the Buddha says the safe and good path that leads to happiness has been reopened, it means that the Buddha is saying, I have discovered this path, and now you can just follow along if you like. The dummy is destroyed. It means the Buddha has seen things as they really are, and for that reason, he can show other beings the same thing. And then the last thing he says here is, what should be done for his disciples out of compassion by a teacher who seeks their welfare and has compassion for them, that I have done for you, monks. There are these roots of trees, these empty huts. Meditate, bhikkhus, do not delay, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. In other words, I have done what I can, I have taught you what I have understood myself. Now put it into practice. It is up to you to practice these things. Nobody can make anybody else do what they don't want to do. So we all are responsible for our own spiritual welfare in the end. All the Buddha can do is point the way. And that is what the Buddha said. The monks were satisfied and delighted in the Buddha's words. So, I will stop there, because that is the end of that particular sutta. And that is like giving you I find this sutta very beautiful myself, gives you a very good taste of meditation, of how the path works. So, does anybody have any questions about what I've said today? Anybody want to ask anything? You're welcome throughout this retreat to ask questions whenever you want. if it's fresh in your mind. And if you don't want to ask questions in public, you prefer to just do it quietly on a piece of paper, please do so. And I will answer those questions this evening later on. Okay, so then let's...